Put knowledge to work and grow your business with CIT. From transportation to healthcare to manufacturing, CIT offers commercial lending, leasing, and treasury management services for small and middle market businesses. Learn more at CIT.com. Put knowledge to work.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Odd Lots podcast. I'm Joe Weisenthal.
And I'm Tracy Alloway.
Hey, Tracy, you know what I was thinking about recently?
No, what?
Remember that time you came over and had dinner at my house?
Yes. You promised that you would make me dinner, and the dinner you made was raw fish. So really, you didn't make much.
I said, is there any kind of food that you don't like? And you're like, well, I'm not really into fish.
Yeah. And you made me raw fish. Thanks, Joe.
But I made fish anyway. I apologize about that. So I, after all this time, like a year and a half later or whatever, a year later, it sort of dawned on me that that was kind of rude.
It was pretty good, though. It was poke, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
Yeah,
thank you.
I'm
glad you liked it. Okay, good. Yeah. Well, that's the perfect seg, because today on our podcast, we are going to talk about fish.
So this is the podcast equivalent of you serving me fish for dinner?
Well, it seems like we have a lot of episodes where I come up with something and then you're like, this isn't really my thing. But they usually turn out kind of well, like that dinner did. So it is kind of like that equivalent, except this time we're not talking about raw fish.
What kind of fish are we talking about?
Well, let's back up real quickly, because obviously in markets, we talk about commodities all the time. And we talk about, you know, we talk about cattle and we talk about wheat and we talk about corn and
pig bellies.
Pork bellies. Yeah, exactly right. We don't really talk about seafood all that much.
No. Is there a thriving seafood commodity market that I should be aware of?
Well, not really. But did you know that there was once sort of a bubble in or a gold rush in U.S. seafood?
In U.S. seafood? I'm really like I'm trying to scratch my head and think about which particular seafood it could possibly be.
Well, let's just cut right to the chase. We are going to be talking about the delicious, one of my favorite fishes, the catfish. And it turns out that there was once a sort of catfish bubble in America. I know, hard to believe, right?
Well, we've seen bubbles in lots of things. The Beanie Babies episode we did was one of my favorite bubbles of all time. So I can believe it. Who exactly is going to be discussing this with us?
Well, we have the perfect guest today. His name is Mike McCall, and he is the editor of the Catfish Journal, a publication on the catfish industry. And he is the author of the book, Catfish Days, From Belzona to the Big Apple, which is all about America's the time we had a catfish gold rush in America. So let's bring in Mike. Mike McCall, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So did I introduce this right? Is it fair to say that there was once a time in America when we once had a catfish bubble, so to speak?
I think that's correct. The way the business came on in the 1960s and started growing in the 70s and really the 1980s and 90s, there was just a big heyday in the business. Everybody had to get into it. And of course, the business is mainly in the South, but people were coming from all over the country. And if you look at the statistics, it was just booming and up until around 2000 and then started going down.
So you mentioned that it, you know, mostly boomed in the South. I was recently in Mississippi where I had some delicious fried catfish at the Taylor Grocery outside of Oxford, Mississippi. So tell us the story. Why did people get so excited that they felt that they had to get into the catfish business back in the 60s and 70s?
Well, it started off slowly and began to pick up some steam. And honestly, the news media, I believe, was a factor because the story was covered as a real novelty in some ways. And it is a novelty, I guess, compared to other agriculture businesses. But it was covered in all the national media. There were events in Washington, D.C., and in New York. And the industry started advertising in 1987. And it was a really nice ad campaign, public relations campaign targeted to food editors for people who were not familiar with catfish. And that really, it was just like going into second gear in a race car. Things really started to pick up.
Joe, your choice of topic is going to backfire on you, because I want you to know I was born in Arkansas. My grandmother lived there pretty much most of her life. And I remember as a young kid going to some catfish farms and looking at the catfish. We also went to chicken farms, but maybe that's a topic for another episode. So, Mike, in terms of the catfish farms, what was the sales pitch? And was the sales pitch aimed at, you know, small operators, like small farmers, to get them into the industry?
There really was no sales pitch to farmers to get into catfish farming. They just gravitated to it. They were looking for something different. Your row crop business was down, and, you know, if you had land and a little money, it's an expensive thing to get into, but people just started gravitating to it. Like Reader's Digest had a story on catfish farming in, I think, about 73, and millions of people read that. And the Catfish Farmers of America office, little one-man office at the time, phone was ringing off the hook. They got thousands of letters. Everybody wants to get into it. So really, people just wanted to get into it.
Now, every great boom or bubble has a story, a dream attached to it. And in the case of catfish, people really thought it was going to become potentially as big as chicken, right? That it was going to be the next great American white meat. People all around the country would just make it a staple of their diets.
Right. That's true. Structurally, there's something quite different about the catfish farming industry compared to, let's say, poultry industry, which is a mature, vertically integrated industry. The poultry companies, Tyson's, whoever, they contract with growers to grow the chickens. They have their own processing plant. They have their own feed mill. So it's a more of a market-driven industry. Catfish is more of a producer-driven industry, because the farmers were growing fish for whoever would buy it from them. And yes, they might own stock in a processing plant. They just kept growing the fish. And that was part of the problem of the bubble, because production exceeded demand. And especially when your important fish started coming in from Asia at a really low price, that those markets were lost. And that's when things started going downhill.
So, Mike, before we get to that point, if I was someone in Arkansas in, say, the late 1980s, and I was interested in getting into the catfish industry, what would I actually have to do in order to participate? And, like, what kind of investment would I have to make? How would I actually begin farming catfish?
Great question.
Well, you'd have to have a pile of money, for one thing, and some land. When you say Arkansas, are you talking about like the southeastern part of the state?
Well, I was born in Blytheville, but my grandmother was in Hope, Arkansas for a long time.
I'm glad we're getting into specifics. I wouldn't want to have a discussion about the economics of catfish farming in Arkansas without pinpointing the region.
Correct. Well, what you would do back in those days, you would talk to people, you would talk to your extension service about the land you own. Would it be good for growing catfish? Is the soil right? Do you have plenty of water? And, of course, do you have the money to build ponds? In some cases, you might have had to buy stock in a processing plant, which gave you rights to sell to that plant. There are a lot of factors. There's an old saying in the business that you're not going to make any money growing fish. You're going to make your money selling fish.
Mm, so
that's kind of something that a lot of people did not think about. we'll get into this later, I guess, but that whole scenario has kind of changed. Things have quieted down, stabilized in the industry. Those things really don't happen anymore.
Let's get even more specific, because our audience is pretty nerdy here, and I think they'll enjoy it. So let's talk about how many acres of land you could get, how much, how big of a pond you would need, and the unit economics in terms of the cost of feed for X amount of catfish protein relative to, say, how much that same energy or feed cost would get you with, say, chickens.
In the early days, some of these catfish ponds were as large as 40 acres or so, and it proved to be highly inefficient. The industry transcended to smaller ponds, easier to manage. When I say smaller ponds, today they're 10 to 15 acres. The old number that's always been bandied about, it's going to cost you about $3,000 per acre to get into the business. Now, that includes building your ponds, forming your levees. And of course, you're going to need a lot of equipment. You're going to need tractors and trucks. You're going to need aeration equipment to produce oxygen in the ponds. You're going to have to, of course, stock your ponds with small fingerlings that you're going to buy from, most likely from somebody else. So let's say you stock your fingerlings, then, of course, you have to grow them. And in the case of catfish, it's going to take you roughly a year and a half to grow that fish to maturity. You're going to pour in the feed in there, which that's dependent on your grain cost, which go up and down. Sometimes it's been very high, and lately it's moderated. So you're going to be spending all that money, and, of course, on people, too. You got to have people to run the farm. And then, in a year and a half or so, the world can change. Prices might be down. They might be up a little bit. Grain prices will be up and down. There are a lot of variables. And, of course, at the end of the cycle, you need to sell your fish to a processing plant. And the processing plant owner and you might not be on the same page. Of course, you want to move your fish in an orderly way, but depending on the market, depending on how much fish are out there, it can be a really difficult thing to work through. That's what happened around 2000 when the industry hit the highest production ever, and yet the fish prices for the farmer were the lowest in 25 years. So, Things happen. Today, inventories are managed better. You don't really have that oversupply. Of course, we've lost so much of the acreage, but it's a more manageable situation now.
Mike, before we get to the overproduction and the bursting of the bubble, I just want to press you on this point, because the description you just gave of how to get into catfish farming, it's not a cheap investment, and it's not an easy investment. It sounds like you have to be pretty serious about it. So could you just dive in a bit more into the psychology of the people who got into this industry, and whether or not, you know, were there companies or like sales reps that were trying to push them into catfish farming?
I don't believe there were actually sales reps. There were people during the early growth years. I guess the processing plants were trying to get people involved in catfish farming because they needed fish. And that was the dynamic at the time. When things started going better, the bankers started pushing people to get into catfish because in the South, your row crop prices were really low. And there were people with land, and they wanted to get something better out of that land. In catfish farming, your yield per acre, back in those days, a guy could raise 5,000-6,000 pounds of catfish for a year. He could sell that much catfish compared to a cotton field or soybean field or something. The return was much higher. So that was a real financial incentive to get into it. So I don't know of that answer your question. It's just a simple matter of people wanting to get more out of their farm. And a lot of them were diversified. They continue to do row crops. But here are some catfish that they could grow and could really churn some money at the time. It was just another market to get into for a farmer.
I feel like the detail about the bankers encouraging farmers to get into catfish is a sort of crucial classic stop on any bubble. I want to take a quick break for a word from our sponsor.
Put knowledge to work and grow your business with CIT. From transportation to healthcare to manufacturing, CIT offers commercial lending, leasing, and treasury management services for small and middle market businesses. Learn more at CIT.com. Put knowledge to work.
And we are back with Mike McCall. He's the editor of the Catfish Journal, and he is the author of the book Catfish Days, From Belzona to the Big Apple. We are talking about the time, the true story of when America actually had a catfish bubble, mostly in the South. I want to get very soon to the sort of bursting of the bubble. But before we do that, I want to ask you, in any great boom or bubble or gold rush or whatever it is, you're always going to find some colorful, larger-than-life characters who really defined the moment. From your view, who are some of the most interesting people, the prime movers of the catfish boom?
Well, in the Mississippi Delta, which is a major agricultural area, there were some interesting folks who got into that business. But there are also a lot of people who came from outside of the business and thought they could make big money. If you recall how I started off the book, Joe, with a group up in New York, mm-hmm. that decided they could see the growth of the industry, they could see the slick advertising. This is late 80s. They jumped into it, raised $20 million or so, came down to South Texas, built a farm, built a processing plant, and went straight down the tubes. So there was that kind of dynamic going on. Insofar as individuals, I have to be careful about mentioning names.
Sure.
So I'll try to walk around that.
All right.
Money was flowing everywhere back in the heyday, and I say the 1980s were probably the heyday up until around 1990. People were spending money in any way they can, but the profits were so big. There were lots of parties. There were lots of traveling. I don't know how to explain it. It was just money was going everywhere, and it appeared to be no end to it too. And when they looked around one day and realized that they couldn't sell the fish, they didn't have money to buy feed because they weren't selling any fish. And then boom, I guess that's when things started. Around 2000, started going down the hill.
So, Mike, what was the exact tipping point for things to go downhill? Was it just overproduction, or was there something else?
It was basically two things. Production was overshot the market, and then you had cheap fish from Asia that started coming in, mainly from Vietnam, some from China, and they took over the markets. Normally, when the industry would overproduce, eventually things would tighten up, supply would tighten up, and they'd just keep on going. But this time, they lost sales to the restaurant chains, to the food service companies, and it just started going down the hill. And it took 10 years to work out those inventories in the pond. And people drained their ponds. They couldn't do it anymore. Feed prices got very high, and they just couldn't. They couldn't hold on. That's why we've lost over half the industry. You know, at some point, you know, your banker's going to shut you down if you don't shut it down yourself.
Do you have any stats in terms of how big the either overall or specifically in a state like Mississippi, how much acreage was devoted to catfish farming at the peak, and how much it's come down to now?
In Mississippi, they had about 110,000 acres of water catfish production in 2002, 2003. Today, they're down to 35,000 acres from Mississippi. So they went from 111,000 acres in 2002 to 35,000 acres in 2016. Arkansas, Tracy, went from 38,000 acres down to less than 5,000 acres. So people were just, they just couldn't hang on. They had to do something.
So what exactly happened to the farmers? And I'm assuming, you were talking about the bubble at its heyday. You were talking about parties and lots of money flowing. So I'm assuming there were some people who made, a great fortune from catfish farming. What happened to them when the bubble burst?
They just had to get out. And, some of them had other means of income. They were growing the row crops. The grain prices got very high. They could still make money off of that. The processing plants probably fared a little better than the farmers did in those days. I know of one case where an owner of a catfish plant in Alabama made, in the worst year for the farmer in 25 years, he made $6 million that year and actually turned around and sold the company a year or two later. And made a bunch more money. So there was still some money to be made, but for the rank-and-file farmer, they just had to get out. Some of them lost homes, and the banks took over some of them. Some of the farms were converted to wetland reserve programs where they could make a little money off of that. The goal was to return the land to its original purpose, and the government would pay a little bit for that. Some were turned into hunting clubs and stuff. Some of them are just sitting there, nothing. They're grown up in weeds, and it's just kind of sad to see it like that.
That is a depressing image. It kind of reminds me of some of the crazy boomtime housing developments right before the housing crash in Florida and California, and then revisited.
That's true.
2009, 2010, in a state of disarray with weeds and decay and everything. We got to, wrap it up here. But finally, so what's the state of the industry right now? Is it growing? Is it stable? I mean, you're still chronicling catfish at the Catfish Journal. So what is the equilibrium that it's settled in at?
Well, it took roughly 10 years to work out this oversupply of fish and for people to make the exit from the business. I'd say about 2012, things began to stabilize. At its peak, the industry processed 660 million pounds, and around 2012, it was like a little over 300 million pounds. And since 2012, it's sort of gyrated between 300 million pounds and maybe 330 million pounds. So with a tight supply, prices have come up for the farmer and the processor. So there's an equilibrium that's been achieved at this point. I don't think we'll see much growth. You might see a little bit. I'm hoping that you won't see it go down any further. There are a few farms that are operated by some, they're all family owned. And in the family business, if there's nobody to come along behind you to take it over, basically shut it down. There's a little bit of that that's going on too.
Mike, I have one more quick question. I don't like fish, but I know Joe does, and I'm sure some of our listeners do. Where's the best place in the South to eat catfish?
I don't know if I can jump into that.
Too controversial.
Taylor Gross is a great spot. There are places all over. I weave in the Middendorf story in the book, which probably has introduced catfish to more people because it's the gateway in New Orleans. There's so many great places, and
what's the name of the place in New Orleans again?
Middendorf. I talked about them in the book. And you might not have got to that point, but it's out. It's north of New Orleans on Interstate 55 in Manchac, Louisiana. A very famous place that opened in 1934.
Ah, yeah.
And it's they have special fin fried catfish it's wonderful. But Tracy, let me mention something about not liking fish.
No.
Americans are not fish eaters. Unfortunately, that's part of the problem. Compared to most every country in the world, Americans are at the low end of the scale on eating fish. For example, we eat roughly 15 pounds per capita. That's everything. That's shrimp, tuna, catfish, everything. Just for example, Germany is more than twice that amount, probably about 35 pounds per capita annually. And then you get into other countries, they're much higher. In Asia, Japan is about 120 pounds per capita. So, you know, if people ate one more pound of fish per year in the U.S., that'd be a game changer.
Well, hopefully today's episode does a little bit in furthering America's increased consumption of fish. Mike McCall, the editor of the Catfish Journal and the author of Catfish Days from Belzona to the Big Apple, thank you so much for joining us on the Odd Lots podcast. Fascinating story, really interesting book, and I appreciate you coming on.
Thank you so much.
So, Tracy, I think we really have to do an Odd Lots road trip to Middendorf's in Manchac, Louisiana.
Oh, I am so there. I will even eat fried catfish in order to.
You know,
do that.
Have you had fried catfish? Because a lot of, like, I have family members who don't like fish, but they totally make an exception for fried catfish because it's not fishy when you eat it. It's, you know, it's like, it's just good fried food.
I think, like, for me, the thing about fish, it's more the idea. It's more the, like, scaly, slimy fishies that you are eating.
Catfish isn't like that, so.
Well, anyway, I'm trying to get over it. I did go to your house, so you'll have to invite me over for more fish at your place.
Sounds good. But also, I do really like that story because it makes me think that there's probably numerous sort of booms and bubbles and gold rushes and whatever you want to characterize it as, sort of that we never hear about. We know about the big ones, whether it's, you know, stocks or internet. The internet bubble or even Beanie Babies. But I suspect there's just numerous more out there for the finding.
Yeah, you know what I was thinking about while he was talking about catfish? Do you remember a couple years back, there was a lot of talk about buying alpacas and farming alpacas? Do you, like, that was the only sort of agricultural equivalent that I could think about. But the thing I love about all these bubbles is the psychology is, you know, it varies a little bit, but it's almost always the same. It's, you know, people get kind of lured in by the promise of higher returns, and eventually there's so much money pouring in that you reach some sort of tipping point. I guess when you get to the tipping point, that's the most interesting thing, right? And if you get the timing right, then you can become a millionaire. And if you get the timing wrong, then you lose everything.
Also, how awesome do you think like a catfish party was in the 80s? Like, don't you, like, I just want to be at one of those parties so bad right now.
So you've read the book, right? Are there photos in the book? I want to see photos of a catfish party.
There are more photos of farms, not so much photos of the parties themselves. But in my mind, they're the most fun parties in the world.
Yeah, I'd love to see that.
All right. Well, on that note, so Tracy, you have a standing offer to come eat catfish anytime. I'll make some. But until then, this has been another episode of the Odd Lots podcast. I'm Joe Weisenthal. You can follow me on Twitter at The Stalwart.
And I'm Tracy Alloway. I'm on Twitter at Tracy Alloway.
And you can follow our fabulous producer, Sarah Patterson, on Twitter at Sarah Pat with two T's. Thanks for listening.
Put knowledge to work and grow your business with CIT. From transportation to healthcare to manufacturing, CIT offers commercial lending, leasing, and treasury management services for small and middle market businesses. Learn more at CIT.com. Put knowledge to work.